Okay, here we are with Tomer Weller, VP of Product of Stellar. Tomer, welcome to the Defiant Podcast. It's great to have you.
Thanks. It's great to be here, Camilla. I'm a big fan, so excited for the show.
Yay, awesome. So super curious to learn more about Stellar. I know, this is one of the so-called alt layer ones that has been around probably the longest. It goes back to 2014. So even pre-Ethereum, it's recently launched smart contracts. So lots going on in this community. But yeah, let's start from the very beginning. If you can just provide an overview of Stellar, the founding story, and what makes it different from all the other layer ones that seem to be coming up every other day now.
Sure, yeah. We have been around for a while, so maybe we should call the other one the alt ones. So Stellar, like you said, was founded in 2014. We recently celebrated a decade. It's an L1 really focused on financial inclusion and equitable access from the ground up. And back when we started in 2014, it was really focused on cross-border payments, asset issuance, and everything that relates to that. And with time, this has expanded to include a larger set of everyday financial services. So we have things like trading real world assets these days, various savings accounts, people hedging against inflation. And now with our new smart contracts platform, Soroban, the possibilities have expanded and we're starting to see more DeFi primitives like lending and borrowing. And they're taking advantage of the existing financial infrastructure that Stellar already offers.
Awesome. And how about yourself? How long have you been at Stellar and what's kind of your background that what led you to join?
Sure. So I'm originally from Israel and I worked on a few consumer startups back in the day and eventually made my way to the MIT Media Lab for grad school and doing research. And I was working both on distributed systems and a plethora of other things. I was really interested in digital fabrication as well. My last project there was working on a 3D glass printer, which is very different from blockchain. And eventually in 2017, I was visiting San Francisco, trying to figure out my next steps. And I met up with a friend from MIT, Jeremy Rubin, who happens to be a Bitcoin Core contributor, and at the time was doing some consulting work for Stellar, for the protocol. And even though I insisted that I know nothing about blockchain, I actually thought that Bitcoin was dead, to be honest, at that time, he convinced me that I'm an idiot, and that I think those were his exact words. And I met up with Jed McCaleb the following day, the founder of Stellar. And I met up with him, met up with David Mazieres, who's the actual Stanford professor who came up with a consensus protocol. And I was just really excited both about the tech and about the mission itself. And so the following week, I packed my stuff up from Boston and moved to San Francisco. And this was September 2017.
Yeah, it must have been very compelling to hear this vision from, all these founders and Bitcoiners. Can you talk about the Stellar tech that you mentioned a bit more get into the details a bit further?
Sure. So, like I said, Stellar is an L1 blockchain. It's based on the Stellar consensus protocol. That is the consensus protocol, which is what we call a proof of agreement. So as opposed to other networks in which you have basically like the currency that is being staked is either, actual cryptocurrency or computational resources. With Stellar, it really is based on reputation. So every validator on the network has what we call a quorum set, which is a set of the other validators that I trust. And what the network does is it actually extracts from this graph of trust a quorum intersection, and based on that, it makes decisions. And this is actually very similar to how financial institutions work and how correspondence banking works, like in which, the trust is based on reputation and is transitive. So whenever you're transacting with another bank, either, your banks kind of like trust each other or you trust some other financial institution. So you have like transitive trust between you. So that's the consensus protocol. In terms of the actual protocol itself, like what you can do on the network, like the application protocol, like I said, it was really built towards cross-border payments originally. So, you know, we had first-class primitives for things like issuing an asset, for things like making a payment, making a trade on a built-in DEX. So there's like this canonical DEX inside of the protocol. And all the primitives you would expect from like a crypto network. So things like multi-sig accounts, hash locks, time locks. And with the years, we've added more and more features, some of them for regulated institutions. For example, one requirement that kept coming up is this idea of like clawback for like super regulated assets. So that is something that we added throughout the years. We've added fine-grained permissions, again, for like the more regulated assets. We've added AMMs, I think it was 2021, with the idea of kind of like opening the network for more retail market makers rather than the, so we still have like the order books, but the order books are kind of like more, they cater for the more institutional market makers, and AMMs can cater for like the retail ones. So around 2 years ago, I would say, we finally hit this point in which we realized that in order to unleash innovation in the network, and this is what the ecosystem has been asking for, we really need to decouple protocol upgrades from introducing new types of innovation. And the way to do that is to add a runtime for smart contracts. So around 2 years ago, we started this process of adding smart contracts. We built our own runtime. It's called Sorobon. We've been building this for the past couple of years in the open, and I'm proud to say that it is finally live on mainnet. We've had a phrased release approach, and as of last week, it is live.
Congrats on that. That's amazing. It's interesting that you mentioned all these use cases that, you know, Stellar had from before having smart contracts, like AMMs. You would assume that you need smart contracts in order to do that, but it sounded like, you know, that was part of the kind of like base layer upgrades that developers were doing as part of the like the growth of the layer one. But now I think is kind of the next step to, like you said, just like have this kind of neutral smart contract platform for any developer to come and build whatever they want on it.
Exactly. Yeah. So in the past, you could think about the protocol features as being kind of like enshrined in the core protocol. Mm-hmm. There was no kind of like, whenever you wanted to make a change, it would effectively mean a protocol upgrade. Mm-hmm. And now with the runtime, you can deploy a smart contract. And so the pace of innovation is not coupled with protocol upgrades.
You were so early, like you came before the EVM, before like Turing Complete blockchains. And now you've had to kind of upgrade your infrastructure to enable like all the use cases that other layer ones have. So what are kind of the pros and cons of having been here so early?
Yeah, so I think, you know, Stellar is unique, A, in being so early, but also just because, like, Stellar has always been extremely mission-oriented and focused. You know, if I look back at, you know, like, the early days of smart contract platforms, let's say 2018, with the, you know, with the CryptoKitties craze, for example, which I'm sure you lived through, I think that was, like, really interesting from our perspective because, you know, we were talking with a lot of asset issuers at the time, and a lot of people that have started to look at Ethereum actually came over to Stellar and when CryptoKitties were like clogging up the network, and they were like, look, we can't build on a network that gets congested with this like ridiculous stuff. So it actually was very beneficial to us to you know, because we were indeed so focused. But I think throughout the years, we've realized and learned that, you know, smart contracts do allow for a specific type of innovation that we were lacking. And so I wouldn't, you know, this is not us pivoting in any way. I think we have like a really solid foundation with the current Stellar network. You know, we have our bread and butter, which is the Anchor network, which is this interoperable network of on and off ramps around the world, from like small on ramps or small ish on ramps in places like, you know, Brazil and Argentina, all the way to something like MoneyGram, which is this, you know, super anchor. MoneyGram allows you to move from like, you know, USDC on chain to cash in your hand in more than 300,000 locations around the world. And you know, we have this amazing infrastructure already being used by, you know, by folks, for example, like the UN, which is distributing aid in Ukraine through this network. We have like reputable, players like Franklin Templeton, WisdomTree that are issuing real world assets on Stellar and side of like Franklin Templeton. I think their Benji fund is over $400 million worth right now, which is the biggest in any chain right now. And so we already have this great infrastructure. It's like not going anywhere. And with DeFi, we're basically kind of like allowing people to innovate on top of that. And so at the end of the day, I think that being like a late mover here means that, A, we have like this really established base layer. But it also means that, you know, from a purely technical perspective, we had a great opportunity to learn from, you know, what is working and what is not working in other platforms and other smart contract runtimes.
Awesome. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so then it becomes more interesting to learn why, you know, you made the choices you did for your smart contracts platform. So why go with Rust and WebAssembly, you know, different from, you know, Solidity or like, you know, Ethereum's and like other EVM's approach?
Sure. So like I said, being a late mover really allowed us to kind of like look at the entire industry and figure out, you know, look at everything that's out there, experiment with it. We actually had a team of engineers that were building, that were looking at different ecosystems, building smart contracts in different runtimes. And eventually we decided on WebAssembly and Rust. WebAssembly is this bytecode standard, super robust, super common. It's actually in your browser and in any browser. It was built for this extremely adversarial environment, which is the web. And we have a lot of tooling in this ecosystems, interpreters, compilers. We're actually part, the Stellar Development Foundation is part of the Bytecode Alliance, which is the like premier nonprofit that works on developing a lot of these tools alongside folks from, you know, Microsoft, Amazon, Google, and others. And on top of that, we're using Rust, which is, you know, according to all the programming languages surveys, it is one of the most, you know, loved programming language out there. It is admired. There are a lot of people that are using it. Actually, also in crypto, we're seeing a lot of people using using Rust, not always in the context of smart contracts. It was built for safety from the ground up. And I think that's often overlooked is it's a very established programming language. That is, you know, there's a Rust foundation. There's a very clear governance process for the language. We know where it is going and we're comfortable with that. And I think that's very important and better than a lot of the other things we see out there.
It's what Solana uses as well, right? For its smart contracts.
Solana uses the Rust programming language, but they actually use a different type of bytecode format, which is called BPF or eBPF. And so it is a bit different, but they're a bit of a special unicorn or a special thing. We were seeing, I think in the Rust space, WebAssembly is probably the most common bytecode standard. It's definitely the most robust from everything that we saw out there. It's used by folks like the Cosmos ecosystem and Cosm Wasm, by Near, by Definity, and by others as well.
So having the same programming language as Cosmos, and even if, I don't know, if Solana uses another kind of Rust, is it easy for, you know, builders on Solana and Cosmos to port their apps onto Stellar?
Yeah, I would say it's definitely easier. It makes it, you know, for example, if anyone has done like front end development, I often compare moving between like the different Rust ecosystems to like moving between different like JavaScript platforms, like moving between Angular and React. It's the same programming language. A lot of the concepts are similar, but, you know, it's not fully compatible. You still need to make adjustments when you move between them. And that's different. You asked about the EVM. EVM has this concept of like bytecode compatibility, which is if you're EVM compatible, you can kind of like deploy your contract as is in another network. One of the things that made us weary about the EVM is that, yes, there is this convenience of being able to deploy the same bytecode. But we have to remember that, you know, the EVM bytecode was developed kind of like in a haste in 2015 by the Ethereum folks. It is not necessarily the most robust bytecode format out there. And adopting that format in like 2024 means that you're actually bringing in all the baggage of the EVM. So say, for example, you know, if you look at something like reentrancy attacks, like we all know that enabling reentrancy by default is a fundamental design flaw of the EVM, but you still have chains launching in 2024 with this vector of attack, all in the name of EVM compatibility. And the problem with EVM is that you can't actually make any changes to it, because if you make any changes, then you make your EVM not compatible with other EVMs. So you kind of like lose the basic kind of like value prop.
I mean, I definitely get kind of the pros and cons on of like using more advanced developing languages, but you still have to try to like overcome the network effects of this like, you know, big ecosystem. So, you know, how do you think you can attract more developers, more users over to Stellar's ecosystem?
Yeah, I agree that if you look at the existing like pie of developers, there is definitely a strong EVM dominance there. And when we first started this journey 2 years ago, I think that going for like a non-EVM was probably not an easy decision to make. We made it because at the end of the day, we had a set of requirements that were important for us. Now, 2 years later, I'm very confident that we've made the right decision. And I think that the nice thing is that you can actually see in the wider ecosystem that there is, in fact, a lot of non-EVM development happening right now, right? So we're already seeing that the EVM is not necessarily the end all, and we're seeing that developers and product builders go for the right chain for them. So they go for, you know, the chain that's good for like their demographic. And a lot of them are interested in learning about other options out there. You know, I don't think, you know, Solidity is not exactly what one would consider like a good programming language in any way, not to talk too much bad things. But like at the end of the day, you look at a language like Rust and there's like no comparison. And so we are seeing a lot of people in the Rust ecosystem that are looking at blockchains. And they're looking for this idiomatic Rust like developer experience. And so I do think that as we increase the size of this pie, the percentage of developers that are like just focused on like one specific network, especially the EVM, that's like going to go significantly down.
I have no idea who would need to make this possible, or if it even is a possibility, but is there a chance of making like Rust compatible, like building Rust compatibility?
Compatibility with the EVM, you mean?
No, between like all the different Rust chains. So like you'd have like the EVM chains that can just simply deploy an app on another chain. Like if you could do the same with like all the Rust-based blockchains.
Definitely. And I definitely think that as this ecosystem evolves, we're going to see more of these abstraction layers that allow you to do, you know, cross-chain deployment, communication, and make it just a lot more seamless. One of our collaborators, actually, Cubist, have a what they call the Cubist SDK, which allows you through like a single SDK to deploy contracts to multiple networks and actually have them communicate with one another through a bridge. In their case, they're actually using Axelar. Axelar are in the process of integrating with Stellar. So yeah, I definitely think that, you know, similar to how in other ecosystems you have, you know, multiple platforms and you have multiple abstraction layers, you know, like I look at something like, you know, like mobile development, for example, in which you have, you know, in which you have like, you know, you have iOS development, you have Android development. And then within these ecosystems, you have like multiple ways of writing contracts. You can write a contract to programs. You can write a program for Android in Kotlin, or you can write a program in Java. You also have these like things like React Native, which actually target different platforms. So I think there's a lot of mixing and matching that's going to happen throughout the years. And I would say being any kind of like chain or runtime maxi for the long run is like probably not the right way to go. And by the way, one of the reasons why we chose WebAssembly is because it's such a robust like bytecode standard and runtime that you can actually build with other programming languages for it. So we're really focused on Rust now. But if you look at the wider ecosystem, there's actually a Solidity project called Solang. Solang is a Solidity compiler that targets Solana. It targets Polkadot. And they're now in the process of adding support for Stellar. So you can with like the same, and this is Solidity, so it's not 100% EVM compatibility, but you still get the same programming language. We see people utilizing new programming languages that work really well with WebAssembly. For example, Zig is this programming language that's up and coming and super popular with kind of like the low level system programmers. And I do think that we're going to see things like these adapt for blockchain, and specifically for WebAssembly, and Stellar is ready for that with WebAssembly.
Awesome. Can we talk about some of the use cases and institutions, projects, companies using Stellar right now? So you mentioned some pretty big ones earlier. You mentioned the Franklin Templeton Fund, the UN, you know, a couple of other institutions using Stellar. So yeah, would love to kind of dive into these use cases.
Sure. So like I said, in the heart of the Stellar network, there is the Anchor network. The Anchor network is a set of interoperable on and off ramps around the world. So it's basically like a financial institution that will implement a set of APIs for depositing and withdrawing. So for example, I think I mentioned, for example, Ntokens in Brazil, they use the Brazilian fast payment service, fast bank payment service, it's called Pix, to allow you to move from Real in your bank account to Real in to a Real stablecoin through the Pix messaging layer. So it's a matter of seconds to move between, like, you know, between a bank account and a Stellar wallet. Similar with Argentina, for example, we have Settle, which do the same thing with the Argentinian peso. So we have a lot of these companies around the world. MoneyGram, like I said, is the biggest one. And they have like this really robust global cash network that you can move between USDC on-chain and your local currency on and off. And so we already have payment services that are utilizing this, especially payment disbursements is a is a use case that has really caught on. Specifically, what I mentioned before is that the UNHCR and the IRC, which are refugee organizations, part of the UN, they're actually dispersing aid in Ukraine using that network. So dispersing cash, cash aid is actually an extremely difficult task. And usually you will actually have people that are kind of like on the boots on the ground that are actually delivering cash. One interesting thing is that MoneyGram is still active in Ukraine. And so what these UN organizations are doing is basically they're deploying Stellar wallets to their users. And then the user or the recipient can choose whether to hold a stablecoin in their wallet or to take this out as cash using a MoneyGram agent. So if they're like about to cross a border, for example, which often happens with refugees, they probably don't want to be carrying like a lot of cash on them. So they would rather keep this as a stablecoin. But if they are actually if they actually need to do shopping with or whatever with the funds, they can actually take them out of a MoneyGram agent. So that's been super helpful, and we're seeing this like payments and disbursements use cases really taking off, not necessarily just in aid, but also in things like payroll services, for example. So let's say, for example, that you have a company that has like a global payroll and you need like a unified way to send people money. The Anchor Network can help you do that.
Super interesting. I mean, you mentioned a disbursement of cash to third world countries and to refugees. And I'd love to hear kind of the potential challenges you've come across in just, you know, kind of the learning curve of getting people to just like regular people, non-crypto people, to use a wallet to transfer, you know, tokens and convert to cash. Like, what's that education process like? And like, do you need like a huge team to be on the ground, you know, helping this happen? Like, how has that been?
Yeah. So luckily, when the UN started talking with us about this, we have already established some really important infrastructure to make this happen. So like I said, the MoneyGram and the Anchor Network were already there. Another thing that was already there is that for the past few years, we've been developing a non-custodial wallet in-house. We call this Vibrant. And Vibrant is a wallet that is really focused on the non-crypto native user. So the idea is there is no complicated like key management for the user. All the transfers are gasless transfers. So really, really focused on like the common user. It's still non-custodial. We have basically this, we implemented a recovery signer method in which you actually distribute shards of your keys to like third parties. And then if you lose your if you lose your phone, if you lose access to the app, you can actually recover your account by authenticating with two recovery signer services. So we've already put a lot of effort into making this user friendly. And when the Ukraine project started happening, what we've done is we've taken this Vibrant wallet, we actually created a new build of it that is like completely kind of like vanilla and really like doesn't have any advanced crypto features. So really just focused on what these users are doing, which is holding the money and cashing out. And that's it, right? Like really, really simple user experience. And so that has been you know, super helpful. You know, there's definitely, this has been, you know, a learning curve for us. And we've learned this. Survivement is mostly used these days in outside of the Ukraine context. It's actually used in Argentina for hedging against inflation. And so for the past few years, we've been learning about all the difficulties that people have in onboarding to a crypto wallet and have been dealing with that. And actually, in the past, ever since the presidential elections in Argentina, we've been seeing a huge demand for like these type of financial instruments. And because there are like less regulatory hurdles these days, these things are really picking up.
Oh, so interesting to see that you've seen a change in Argentina after the after Milei took office.
Yeah, I think Vibrant has seen like close to like a 60% increase in like in recurring users after that. Yeah.
Oh, crazy.
Yeah.
This is maybe going off on a tangent, but I'm just like passionately interested in Argentina. I lived there for a while, and I just think it's, you know, it's a fascinating country. So I read recently that crypto is becoming more popular than ever now because actually the black market dollar exchange rate has actually gone down since Milei took office. Well, obviously, you know, crypto is going up, so people are wanting to buy more crypto now to protect against, you know, to exchange for pesos, which, you know, have huge inflation problem and so on. So, yeah, it's interesting to see that's also, you know, helping boost your guys' use and activity.
Yeah, and I think so. I was actually in Buenos Aires last year. We had like a Stellar ecosystem get together there, mm-hmm. and it was just amazing to see. It's been a few years since I went to Argentina last time, and the interesting thing, and you know this if you've lived in Argentina, is that like people are constantly obsessing about money. Like this is like always in the back of your head, right? So people are always looking to, you know, hold as little lead pesos as possible so that they can kind of like maximum their kind of like value preservation. And so when you go in downtown Buenos Aires, it's like wherever you go, people are offering you like these changes, these like cash changes, cambios. And it feels wonky, right? Like you're walking downtown and like everyone's like obsessing over cash, and if you tell something that you would, they'll take you to like a street corner to like this cambio, and it just doesn't really feel safe. And what I loved last time when I was there is that I could actually I have a Lobster wallet. It's one of the biggest wallets in the Stellar ecosystem. They're integrated with MoneyGram, so I could literally just like do an off ramp from USDC to cash through MoneyGram, and MoneyGram actually gives you the black market. Sorry, I shouldn't call this the black market. They give you kind of like the street value of USD pesos, unlike the banks, which will often give you kind of like the official value.
MoneyGram uses the blue rate. They call it blue rate, actually.
Yeah, the blue rate, yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay, so yeah, Argentines must be going crazy over that.
Yeah, and that's why it's successful there. And it was just like a really pleasant experience. Like you just you set up the transaction from your wallet. You show up to a place where the map sends you to. It's a MoneyGram location. They ask to see your passport, ask you a few questions, and you get the money immediately.
Oh wow! So you can exchange Argentine pesos at the blue market rate and get USDC in your Stellar wallet in like a physical, like safe office MoneyGram.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. Very cool. So that's kind of the payments cash use case, and then you were mentioning Franklin Templeton issuing a tokenized fund, I think, on Stellar.
Yeah. So Franklin Templeton has Benji. Benji is kind of like their biggest on-chain tokenized fund. It's on Stellar. I think it crossed $400 million just last week. And we also have Wisdom Tree that are active on the network and issuing more and more funds online on chain. So there's definitely kind of like a big move there. And I can tell you, we are at the SDF getting a lot of incoming you know, questions from like some of these big financial institutions around how to do that. So I definitely think that real world assets are like a big use case in blockchain, and it is one that a lot of companies feel free to do on Stellar. And this, you know, the fact that we have this track record with regulated financial institutions, the fact that assets on the Stellar network were really built with compliance in mind. And the fact that the Stellar Consensus Protocol has a kind of like a trust model that sometimes it's easier for like a financial institution to wrap their head around, because they know that at the end of the day, kind of like trust is the main currency, rather than them having to actually dabble in like, you know, cryptocurrency stake and stuff like that.
Okay, so two follow-up questions on that. The first, like, if you can get into more detail on what those funds are, is it like U.S. Treasury yield fund, or what exactly are they?
Yeah, it's like a money market. Yeah, it's like a USD-denominated money market, yeah.
Both the Franklin Templeton one and the Wisdom Tree ones?
The Wisdom Tree ones, I'm actually not up to speed. I think so, but I can give you an answer later.
This Benki fund is $400 million. Just like very, just fact-checking question with DeFi Llama. I'm seeing that TVL on Stellar shows up as like 30 million. Is that something wrong with how like DeFi Llama is accounting for TVL or?
Yeah, so DeFi Llama is just counting the canonical DEX of Stellar. If you go to a real world assets tracker, for example, rwa.xyz, mm-hmm. And enter their platform, you'll be able to see in the dashboard that Stellar accounts for more than 50% of the total real world asset count.
Oh, wow. So Stellar has 50% of all real world assets on chain?
More than that. Yeah, Stellar is the biggest player in this space. Yeah.
Oh, nice. Okay. And then the second question I had on, you know, what you mentioned, why institutions want to tokenize funds on Stellar. So some of the things you mentioned, kind of this permissioned aspect, the clawbacks, all of that. So those, you know, are probably great features for institutions, but could somebody, you know, make the argument that is making Stellar less censorship resistant? Like can an institution or a government or somebody come in and say, you know, you have this, you know, capabilities of making someone, you know, revoking somebody's access to the chain or clawing back funds. So, yeah, does that kind of go against censorship resistance?
Yeah, so I think that there's a spectrum here. And Stellar allows the asset issuer to decide where on the spectrum they're at. So if you're on Stellar as an issuer, you can issue an asset that has like no restriction. You can kind of like turn off all of these like flags so that it's not allow listable, it's not deny listable. It's just kind of like an open asset. And you can guarantee to whoever holds this asset that no admin action can actually be done on their ballots. So you can have it on that end of the spectrum. And then we have all these different flags that an asset issuer can choose around their asset. So they can choose to have an asset that is kind of like deny listable, which means that the issuer can actually revoke your trust line or your balance. And by the way, this is actually very common in stablecoins across the ecosystem. Even, you know, USDC on Ethereum can be, your balance can be revoked by Center or by Circle, right? So at the end of the day, it's part of the game if you're like a regulated entity. And on the kind of like the most extreme end of the spectrum is the heavily regulated assets. So these are things like equities, for example, or securities. And in order for their issuer to be compliant, they must provide some facilities like clawback. But again, it's up to the issuer to decide, and it's visible to the user whether my balance is actually clawbackable or not. And in other ecosystems, you know, we do see there are some, you know, EIPs around kind of like more advanced regulated assets in Ethereum that at the end of the day, this is what they implement. So in Stellar, it's kind of like, you know, you get what you see. It's there from the ground up. It's up to the issuer to make the decision on like what these flags are. And it's up to the user to make the decision is in like, what am I willing to hold?
I'm curious, you know, with the recent Dan Kuhn upgrade on Ethereum, and also just this ongoing conversation about having a layer one and a layer two ecosystem, or having a monolithic chain, or having a composable chain. What camp is Stellar on in this discussion?
That's a great question. I'll do this two parts. First of all, let's talk a bit about the Dan Kuhn upgrade and kind of like how this actually validates some of the design decisions that we've made with smart contracts. And then maybe we can have a more philosophical conversation about scaling strategies. So I think, you know, obviously the Dan Kuhn upgrade and the main EIP there is EIP 4844 has gotten a lot of attention for like enabling L2s. But I think that if you kind of like peel off the L2 use case for a second and look at what the actual product they launched is, then there are kind of like two main things there. One of them is this idea of transient storage, right? This idea that actually kind of like not all storage, not everything that we store in a blockchain needs to live forever. And this is especially important for like, you know, for proofs or like optimistic rollups and stuff like that. And so they've basically built a blob store that allows you to put a bit of information. It's called a blob, and it's there for effectively 18 days or around 18 days, right? So transient storage is actually something that's like super valuable, and we really, really think it's important. And actually with Sorobond, with our smart contracts platform, we actually allow developers to store information. We call these like temporary ledger entries, and you as a developer can choose how long it will be stored for. For example, let's say that you have like an Oracle price feed data, and that data might actually just be relevant for like 10 minutes or for an hour, right? So it doesn't need to live in on the ledger forever. So you can say, hey, I just want this thing to live for 10 minutes, and then you will pay proportionally. So you will pay just a small amount of rent for these 10 minutes rather than paying for something that lasts there forever. So I think there's a lot of use cases for that around oracles, around various, you know, for example, like bridge transactions that are only valid for like 24 hours or something like that. You just don't need that data to live there forever. And we already know from the Ethereum ecosystem that if you just allow state to grow unbound, then eventually you start running into problems. So I think that transient storage is like one aspect of it. The other aspect, which is kind of like less discussed, but might be even more interesting about it, is kind of like introducing multi-dimensional fees, because actually these the blob store doesn't use the regular gas. It uses a new type of gas, which is called blob gas. And I think that's super important for the health of a network, for the validators to be able to limit and fee different types of resources differently. So the blob store actually has like completely different limits than the regular gas limits. There's a certain amount of blobs that you can store in a block, and there's like how much a blob can actually contain. And so I think that's like super important, and this is something that we've actually incorporated in our smart contracts from the ground up. So we actually meter kind of like different resources consumption separately. So you have like number of instructions, which is like CPU. We have write IO, read IO. We actually have kind of like the total size of the transaction, which is something that's really important for the peer-to-peer layer of a network. So we do measure all of these things separately. And so I think that the Kuhn upgrade is really awesome because it shows you how important these things are. I think there's a lot more that can be done, and these are some of the things that we've added in Sorobond from the ground up.
So when all of these aspects of writing a contract are measured differently, are they all in the end paid with XLM?
Yes. At the end of the day, they do have an XLM cost, but they have... but when you measure them differently, you can actually apply different limits. So the network can actually basically shape the type of traffic and transactions based on, you know, the type of activity that the network as a whole is interested in seeing.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. Now about kind of the more philosophical discussion.
Yeah. So My TLDR is that I think that the L2 rollups are somewhat of a premature optimization right now. And I think that modularity is important for the long term. And I think that, you know, one day when we're going to have a Mars colony and there's going to be like a payment network for the Mars colony, it probably can't be the same network that we use on Earth for like latency or whatever. But I do think that where we are right now, this extreme focus on modularity is probably damaging for the ecosystem. That is, you look at the amount of talent that is being, not to sound too extreme, but like wasted on like infrastructure instead of actually establishing product market fit. And it kind of like goes against everything that we know about, you know, like building companies in tech. Like, we know that product market fit is the most important thing, and that premature optimizations is something that companies get killed because of. And yet, just imagine taking all of this talent that is like building L2s and data availability and all this kind of like rabbit hole of infrastructure, and just have them build products instead, and just imagine like what a different world we'd be in right now, right? And so, you know, we need base layers that can probably handle a bit more than the 12 TPS that Ethereum is handling right now. That's true. But I think going all the way to like this super modular composable future so soon is probably damaging for our ecosystem.
Wow, hot take. I tend to agree with you, actually. I think, you know, just covering the ecosystem and seeing the excessive focus on really kind of obscure infrastructure primitives that, you know, with the number of users that Web3 has right now, you know, it's probably an overkill, or, you know, it's probably premature, like you said.
Yeah, and it's not just an overkill. Like, it actually has like damage. It creates damage in terms of user experience. Like, I think one of the most amazing things about like DeFi is this idea of composability, and how like, you know, one DeFi protocol can actually like compose atomically with this other DeFi protocol. So that means that they can actually make a cross contract call, and all of this happens like atomically within a transaction. But once you start creating these like barriers between all these different chains, you create this like fragmentation. And now, you know, like we say that a DEX on kind of like Starknet is in the Ethereum ecosystem, and we say about a lending protocol on Base that they're part of the Ethereum ecosystem. But these two protocols have no atomic way to actually communicate between themselves, right? So there is value in having all these protocols live in the same kind of like global execution layer.
So that means you are more on the monolithic chain camp at this, right now at least.
I would say more nuanced for now. I think that's like the way to go. I do think that eventually there will need to be these like other sovereign chains. I just think that doing that right now, before this ecosystem even has like clear product market fit, it basically means that you're optimizing on assumptions rather than optimizing on like actual usage patterns.
Yeah, super interesting. Why do you think, you know, the ecosystem has developed this way? Is it like incentives are placed the wrong way? I've seen kind of this argument being made that venture capital is flowing more towards infrastructure startups, and so, you know, more infrastructure startups are getting built.
Yeah, I definitely think that VCs are part of this problem. You know, when Stellar was founded, even when I joined, like VCs were not, crypto VCs were like not big at that point. But it does seem right now that the more kind of like grandiose your infrastructure product is, the more likely it is that you're going to get that big VC money. And I definitely think that's a problem. I also think that there is there's a governance issue with the more like veteran networks. And I actually think that this is something that Stellar has like done really well, which is Stellar actually has like basic like protocol primitives for how to upgrade the network. And I think that Ethereum was not really built with upgradability in mind, not from a technical perspective and not from like a social governance perspective. And so it's just like it's easier to do like small tiny incremental steps on the base layer and kind of like build on these like external layers like Rollup, for example, to take care of scalability. And by the way, this is something that we've also put a good amount of effort into in the past. And I think that when I joined Stellar, we were still working on, various payment channel protocols. And we put out a good amount of kind of like research and actually incorporate this in the protocol. At the end of the day, probably a premature optimization as well, I would say.
So will Stellar need layer twos or do you not... does the chain not need it? Like, if you can give me a sense of throughput and transactions per second.
Yeah, I think that eventually, if you wanna, I think the number that people like to throw around is Visa that can do like 27,000 TPS globally. Obviously for that number, it's going to be very difficult to have like a monolithic network. Stellar does work at scale right now. Our current limit, which is actually configurable, is 1,000 transactions per ledger. A ledger closes every 5 seconds, so our limit is around 200 TPS right now. And we sometimes hit that limit, and that's okay. It's kind of like a natural way, and I think that any sufficiently like cheap network that has sufficient financial activity is going to be working at its limit. And it's up to like the fee market to make sure that the transactions that are important are making it, rather than arbing for like a few cents here and there. So we're already working at scale. Soroban is kind of like an additional execution layer that we've added to Stellar. And so we're kind of like slowly ramping it up. Right now I would say that Soroban can work at like an Ethereum scale, which is not a lot, but that's on top of the existing transactions that you have in Stellar. And we're slowly ramping this up. We've actually built Soroban from the ground up to support parallel execution. And so this is a project that we're working on and we'll launch later this year. We're building the type of ZK primitives into the network that should allow you to build complex ZK constructions, whether it's for like privacy concerns or like a privacy construction or like a ZK rollup style construction. I definitely think that ZK rollups still have a lot of way to go before actually delivering on the type of like scalability and decentralization promise that people are talking about. But I do think that, we will get there. And so that's an option. Is this something that we're like actively pursuing right now? No, I think there's a lot of value in having like a shared execution environment. And so for the foreseeable, for the short and midterm future, we're really focused on scaling Stellar and Soroban themselves.
Okay, so with shared execution, does it mean that Soroban is handling like smart contracts and like the base Stellar chain, I guess, would be handling just like XLM transfers, non-smart contracts?
Yeah, so it's important to remember that this is Soroban is not an L2 or something. It's part of the core protocol itself. So when you submit a transaction, you can submit a transaction to use one of the existing around 20 basic operations. These include things like making a payment, issue an asset, configure your account in like various multi-sig ways, making a payment through the DEX, put an offer on the DEX. So all of these operations that have existed for many years are still there. They are very cheap, both from a transaction fees perspective and also from the validator perspective. Just like running them is very cheap because this is like super optimized low-level code. And then we have, that's kind of like the fast execution lane. And then we have the a bit slower execution lane, but that is the Sorobon smart contract. This is basically you submit a function invocation, and then the runtime will set up like a WASM context for the contract that you're invoking and run it for you. So this has like more sophisticated fees metering, in which, like I said before, we actually meter like different aspects of the resources that you're consuming. And so that's kind of like the Sorobun. But at the end of the day, these are like multiple execution layers. They run on the same software, the same validator. This is not, there's no kind of like new trust assumptions or anything like that.
Got it. And to become a Stellar validator, what are the requirements? Like, do you need like really like sophisticated hardware, or like how much would it cost to become a validator? And also, what sort of incentives do validators get?
So there were a few questions there. First of all, to run a validator, anyone can run a validator. It is, the hardware requirements are very modest. So, like an average low tier AWS machine is good enough. I think an M2 was like at the time, but I think the naming there has evolved a bit. So it doesn't cost a lot. That's in terms of running a validator. Like I said, Stellar Consensus Protocol requires you as a validator to actually point at to configure other validators that are part of your trust form. So just by setting up a validator, you haven't really kind of like changed the trust game of the network all that much until you actually have other validators pointing at your validators as well. And that's more of like a social construction than it is a technical construction. So in terms of cost, very low. In terms of incentives, there are no on-chain incentives for running a validator. That is, folks who are running a validator do that as kind of like public goods that serve their use cases. So for example, a company like Franklin Templeton runs their own validators so that they actually have a vote in the governance of the network and that they have kind of like unmediated access to the network. A company like Lobster, for example, that has they have multiple wallets on the network. Again, they have unmediated access to the network through their validators. So the way that, you know, my mental model is like closer to that of like running like a DNS server or running like, you know, like an email server. It's something that supports your business or your organization. There are no incentives, kind of like on-chain incentives based on that alone.
Okay. So are most Stellar validators are probably, you know, companies, protocols, yeah, building on,
exactly,
Stellar. Oh, interesting. Yeah. And to have, to be part of this trust network, like you said, it's like a social construction. So like, say, I don't know, I'm like another fund, or maybe I'm a DEX and I want to get Franklin Templeton funds on my DEX. I maybe would approach them and be like, hey, like, I want to be part of this ecosystem. Like, will you point your validator to mine? Is that like how it would work?
So I think there's like a distinction here between the application layer and the consensus layer. So I think in terms of like, you know, the flow of funds and like being able to interact with other accounts, that's kind of like in the application layer and it's completely open. Anyone can, you know, pretty much kind of like submit any transaction that, you know, complies with like the basic rule set of the blockchain. And then there is kind of like the consensus level, which is, you know, how meaningful is like Cami's vote in voting for, you know, a transaction set, let's say, or even let's say that there's a protocol upgrade and you want to have a say in this protocol upgrade. For example, let's say that you don't agree with this protocol upgrade and so you want to vote against it or you don't want to vote for it. That in that case, you will need to have kind of like more trust pointed at you, and that requires other validators to actually add you. And, you know, when you come to these validators and say, hey, can you please add me? They'll say, okay, like, who are you? You know, they'll look at the track record of your validators. So there are some services online, Stellarbeat, for example, is one of them, that you can actually look at the track record of different validators. Like, what is their uptime? Who do they vote for? And so you can actually examine other validators before you add them to your quorum set.
If it's all based on, like, off-chain trust assumptions, how can you prevent people kind of colluding or, you know, working together to attack the network?
Well, the question is, let's say, for example, you have you have a malicious actor coming into the network, bringing in 10,000 like validators, right? Because the existing validators on the network, let's say Franklin Templeton, for example, don't actually assign trust to that group of validators, they actually don't have, even though they're bringing like a lot of machines, they don't actually have a significant or any say in the governance of the network, right? So in order for a malicious actor to actually be able to do anything malicious, it's not enough to just like bring in other machines. It's about actually getting other validators on the network to point their trust at you, right? And so someone like Franklin Templeton, you know, which obviously has like, you know, a reputation to uphold, they, you know, they do their due diligence on what type of companies they're actually allocating trust to in their quorum set.
Super interesting model. I don't think I've heard it being used before. So yeah, just I wanted to understand it better. And then to wrap up, what's next? Like, what are the big milestones that you're working towards?
So I think the next steps, like I said, we have this like very we have this very robust financial infrastructure layer, and now we have this like new DeFi layer that is starting to come up. And by the way, I should mention, you know, we started working on Sorobon 2 years ago, had a set of preview releases. We've already had more than 200 projects that actually got funded through the Stellar Community Fund, which we've allocated $100 million for the adoption of Sorobon. So there's a lot of activity in the DeFi space in Sorobon already, even though it just went live. And so the really interesting things happen when you combine some of these like new DeFi primitives with the more established kind of like financial use cases. So one of the wallets in the ecosystem, it's called Beans, a crypto wallet really focused on kind of like expats, really focused on financial, and kind of like making it like accessible for the less crypto native. They've done this, they've demoed an integration with Blend. Blend is a borrowing and lending protocol on Sorobon. And because Beans is already integrated with MoneyGram, you have this like super smooth cash to DeFi experience in which you can kind of like set up a transaction from your wallet, go to a MoneyGram agent, deposit cash, have it go immediately deposited into like a yield bearing lending pool. And I think these are like the type of like interesting things there, because that allows the non-DeFi native people, the non-crypto native people, access to these type of financial instruments around the world. So I think like the thing I'm really excited about is, you know, kind of like the boring stuff, which is just kind of like making, you know, making robust financial instruments available to everyone around the world, I think is what we're going to see and what I'm hoping to see.
Amazing. And then to close and related to what you were saying, what's a big vision for Stellar? Like, if everything goes right in, I don't know, next 10 years, what would you want Stellar to be?
Yeah, so I think, you know, at SDF, we've always called the mission kind of like creating equitable access for the world's financial system. And I think that regardless of what we do, whether it was like, you know, cross-border payments in the beginning, real-world assets then, now what we're doing with DeFi, it's all catering to that. So at the end of the day, I want to see people, you know, around the world, doesn't matter which background they're coming from, to have the same kind of like access to financial instruments that, you know, you in Brooklyn and myself in Santa Monica here have, without any kind of like borders or barriers.
I love that vision. It's what got me into crypto in the first place. Tomer, it was so great having you on the show. Thanks so much for, you know, getting into all the details of Stellar. Really interesting stuff, everything that's happening in this ecosystem. So we'll definitely keep covering you guys. And yeah, thanks again for coming on.
Thank you, Camilla. Have a great day.